This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 2 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today is Part 2 in our series on Harlan Ellison, looking at his work on The Outer Limits. Today we will be discussing Ellison's first Outer Limits episode, Soldier, as well as the short story he based it on, Soldier from Tomorrow, which he also wrote. So, before we get into Harlan Ellison specifically, maybe we should talk about The Outer Limits and what that was, because I know a lot of people are familiar with it, some people not so much. Mm-hmm. I personally had never seen it up until now. So, I mean, of course I was familiar with the opening theme and everything like that, but, you know, I was always more of a Twilight Zone
guy. But I mean, when you're a Twilight Zone fan, you look out, you're like, you hear about The Outer Limits and then you check it out.
Sure. It never popped up on my radar, you know? I wasn't avoiding it or anything. It just never came up. Mm. So, Max, what exactly was The Outer Limits?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's sort of conceptually similar to The Twilight Zone. I mean, they were both anthology shows. The Outer Limits, though, was in some ways more specific and in some ways more general. The Twilight Zone was largely directed by Rod Serling and his intention to make a show about a particular thing, to talk about ethics and morality and existence. And The Outer Limits was very specifically a science fiction anthology show. They made that very clear. Like, the episodes are science fiction, and they're going to be about what the episode needs to be about. And a lot of that was determined by the individual stories. And the first season of The Outer Limits was largely kind of undirected, and there were a lot of sort of monster episodes. And in season two, a new guy took over. It was like 1964. Ben Brady. He took over, and he made it in, like, essentially, he got better people to come in and write the episodes. And Harlan Ellison is one of those people. And season two of The Outer Limits is actually just great. There are bad episodes in it. And there's more bad visual effects than you can possibly imagine. But they were really doing some interesting stuff. Like, they were doing stuff that the best episodes of The Twilight Zone did, with really interesting ideas, really well-done storytelling, really good acting, and really cool explorations of concepts. And in a lot of ways, it has a lot of the same burdens of The Twilight Zone, which was, you know, TV schedule, TV budget, big ideas.
Yeah.
Soldier, not even slightly outside of that scope. Humongous idea.
Yeah.
Shot in like 6 days. I don't even know how they got what they got.
Yeah. Well, it was created by Leslie Stevens, who was a guy who directed a movie after Outer Limits had been completed called Incubus, which is noteworthy for numerous reasons. One is that it was shot by Conrad Hall, who was...
That would not have made my list.
I'm going in order of craziness.
You're going from least to most? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I don't know if it's least to most, but Conrad Hall was a guy. He actually worked on The Outer Limits quite a bit early on in the first half of season one. He is an Oscar-winning cinematographer, hugely influential in the 70s. Would go on to shoot things like American Beauty and Road to Perdition, which he won Oscars for. He was a crazy guy, very well respected in the industry. And he got his start working with Leslie Stevens, doing things like Outer Limits and Incubus. Mm-hmm. Incubus is also noteworthy in that it starred William Shatner, which is probably where Star Trek fans might have heard of it.
Or maybe they saw Blade Trinity.
Maybe they saw Blade Trinity. Because the other thing about Incubus, which is probably most noteworthy, is the fact that it is the only film in history, so far, ever to be shot with all of its dialogue spoken in Esperanto.
Right.
Esperanto being the...
The language that was invented for the purposes of being a universal language that theoretically everybody on the planet could learn, so that we would have a giant global tongue.
Right.
And that didn't work out because it sounded silly.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't go down. But, you know, when you're pushing for a ridiculous idea, like a new language that everyone should learn, you do things like make a movie in that language.
Yeah.
Ideally, you'd make it a really, really good movie.
Yeah. But they made Incubus instead. check it out. I mean, I own it because, you know.
On a dare.
Why not? No, I own it because someone says Incubus is coming out. And I'm like, what? You mean the movie
that stars William Shatner that's in Esperanto?
I need to buy that today.
And I when I heard Incubus is coming out, I was like, oh, I've totally got to watch that once.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. No. Job done.
There was actually a time when I was at school at Columbia in film school, they had a list in the library of all the movies that they had on different formats. And one movie listed on 16 millimeter was Incubus. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I knew a teacher who I knew would be into something like this. And I went to him and I'm like, hey, because I wanted to see it, but you needed a teacher to
sign out film.
The film. So I went to him. I'm like, hey, there's this movie. I don't know if you've heard of it, called Incubus. And he's like, oh, my God, William Shatner, Esperanto. Yes, that movie's amazing. And I'm like, well, I think this school has a 16-millimeter print of it. And he's like, oh, my God, we need to get that out right now. And he pulled it out. And, of course, it was some crappy short film that some student made in the 70s, which did not have William Shatner or Esperanto in it. But I digress.
Yeah.
So he's the guy who created the show, Leslie Stevens. But he didn't really run the show. He was more of a, Rick Berman type figure, I guess. The show in season one was run by Joseph Stefano, who is a Star Trek alum. He wrote the Next Generation episode Skin of Evil. He's the guy who killed Tasha Yar. He's also...
Allegedly.
He's also probably much more famous for his work in film. He was the screenwriter of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which is one of the best movies ever made.
That's the thing you just said.
Which is totally accurate.
It's not.
He, like you were saying, tended to go more Monster of the Week with his episodes. He apparently even had a mandate for having a monster in each episode.
Yeah.
Something which they referred to as the bear.
Yeah.
When he left in season one and they brought on Ben Brady, who really hasn't done much else at all. He was much more of a producer than a writer, it seems.
Well, I mean, the main thing that he did that was brilliant was he brought in really good writers.
Yeah.
That was, and like, ultimately, that's really all you got to do.
Yeah. And they went much more hard sci-fi. And yeah. Season two, it's interesting because I've seen some things in doing some research where there's some people who are like...
I've heard that hard sci-fi thing said many, many times.
Yeah.
That is not really accurate, but okay. That's fine.
Well, whatever. But season one, there are a lot of people out there who think that season one is like... the way it should be, you know, like, oh man, when, you know, after season
what?
One, yeah,
is this
I've heard
a, really,
this,
I've heard never this,
like,
heard that.
Like, man, season two, they decided to get all, you know, serious and stuff, but season one, it was like the fun season, you know.
That's really strange for me because I actually find season one really boring.
Well, they do see, like the more I would say, let's say, intellectual sci-fi people, mm-hmm. like Harlan Ellison, for example, say season one was a piece of crap. Season two is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm not going to take a stand either way because I haven't.
Well, seen I can tell you, a bunch of years ago, they started coming out on DVD.
Yeah.
and I got the season one set. And I was like, this is going to be fun. And I put it on and I watched a few episodes and I was like, I don't want to watch the next one yet. And like, you know, a couple of days go by. And then eventually I realized that I just was never going to watch another one. And then the season two set was coming out like a week. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to burn through season one so I can get up there. And I don't know why I thought that I had to do this. Like some sort of weird nerd completism like gene that sort of flares up from time to time. Like, I was like, they're not in continuity, but I watched all of them, and I really, by the end of it, I hated it. I hated The Outer Limits season one, like, passionately. Like, I was really enraged. And when I watched season two, I watched every single episode in a row, and every time I was like, this next one will probably be great, because, like, really good odds of that. Throughout season two, it's like, the next one might not be great, but it could totally be. Because, you know, there's, like, at least a great one out of every three.
Yeah.
And, like, one of those is still good.
Yeah. One other thing to note that Star Trek fans might be interested in is a lot of the monster effects, makeup, this, that, here and there, things which were used on the original series were taken from The Outer Limits, you know, costumes, you know, or, like, the Horda was originally designed for The Outer Limits, things like that. And there were a number of people behind the scenes from The Outer Limits who went on to do Star Trek. So if you're a fan of the original series and you check out The Outer Limits, you'll probably see a lot of familiar creatures.
And props.
And props.
There are definitely some recurring props.
Sure, yeah. So that's interesting. Now, getting into specifics here. The first episode of season two was written by Harlan Ellison. It was called Soldier. Yeah. And it was based on his short story from 1957 called Soldier from Tomorrow. Now, we read the short story.
Yeah.
Want to give a synopsis?
Well, it's a really short story. The point is that it's a really simple thing. There's a brief little, like, interlude in the beginning where there's a soldier in some sort of war, and there's a lot of description of the battle and the chaos of it.
It's a future war.
And then he just wakes up, like, well, not wakes up, he sort of just gets transported to present day.
Through a freak accident, like, a couple laser beams, like, simultaneously shoot him, they cross the streams or something.
Some particular sci-fi nonsense occurs, and he ends up in the 20th century in the 60s?
1960s? The 50s or 60s, probably 50s. You know, modern day New York, I think.
Yeah.
In like a subway station or something to that effect.
Yeah. And there's some, you know, like fish out of water nonsense that leads to him essentially being interviewed by government employees.
Basically, he freaks out and, you know, he's scared and he basically blows up the front of the train, accidentally kills a guy, and they, you know, arrest him and throw him in jail.
Right. I'm trying to cut to the point where it gets to the story.
All
right. There's a scientist guy who's talking to him, and he realizes that this is a guy from the future, and the nonsense that he's spouting is actually just English, but transformed over many years into a really difficult to comprehend form of English, using the same words, just super abbreviated with a lot of slang words that have replaced other pre-existing words.
It's actually an idea that we talked about last week in regards to City on the Edge of Forever, and how he was sort of touching on that idea too. The idea that someone coming from the future to the past is going to have a hard time understanding what people are saying because English changes over time.
Yeah, and that's totally reasonable. But another interesting thing is that Harlan Ellison, throughout a lot of these things, seems to be writing sort of structurally similar concepts,
mm-hmm.
where he's more or less dealing with the difference between the future and the past and action versus consequence and how ends can't justify the means in any context. And it's a really complicated idea, but he's exploring it in a lot of different ways in order to illustrate the point. And the essentially this soldier explains to him the war, and the guy asks him how he got there, and he's like, I don't know anything about that. I'm not a science nerd. I'm not wearing glasses.
He's literally just a soldier.
He's a jock.
Yeah.
He's a jock from the future who doesn't know how any of it works. So so the intellectual guy decides to start warning people so that we can avoid this particular conflict. And, I mean, obviously that doesn't go as planned. But essentially it's the story of a guy who doesn't really know anything about non-war life,
mm-hmm.
trying to integrate into a world where you're not constantly at war. And of course it doesn't work.
Yeah, well, that's something which is really interesting, because after they get him and they discover what he is, then he almost becomes a secondary character, the soldier.
Yeah.
And it becomes the second half of the story. It basically is kind of an internal monologue of the military guy who's basically been put in charge of what to do with him. So basically what is decided upon after much, you know, hemming and hawing or whatever, is that he's basically of no use to us in society, and he's basically of no use to us as a soldier, but he could be of use to us as a peacemaker. If he is able to tell people what the world is like in the future and how it is the most horrific battleground you could possibly imagine, then perhaps that would be enough to persuade the world to head in a direction of peace. And that is kind of how the story ends. But, of course, there is the lingering question of, do you think it's going to work? It seems to be working. We seem to be going in that direction, but we've still got like 1,800 years until we reach that point.
Sure.
So who's to say? Now, what did you think about the story?
Well, I read it, the first time I read it, I was pretty young. And I recall thinking that, like a lot of time travel stories that deal with the future and the present day, it was a very clever way of doing a very big story on a very small scale, which I appreciated. And at the same time, there's a sort of like a plausibility to it. There seems like a completely reasonable thing. Like, you know, time travel scenarios always feature sort of like weird contrivances, and the idea of an extremely inconvenient time travel scenario where a guy who doesn't know how it works is sent back in time and essentially has no idea what to do with that information. There's no real use for it, and he's basically just kind of stuck. That was a very interesting idea, and the idea that would be kind of a problem is very reasonable. I mean, essentially they deal with the whole he's a wild animal problem for a big chunk of the story, and the Outer Limits version deals with that I think better. In fact.
Okay. Well, I like the story a lot. Like you were saying, I like how it is extremely simple. Even though it's about these big concepts, it takes it and puts it into a very, very manageable level. Like, I could see, like, as I was reading it, I'm like, wow, I could totally see how you could do this on a TV budget, because there really isn't that much science fiction stuff which is visible on screen. In fact, I think there was more in what was aired than there was in the actual story.
Well, the benefit of that is that in the short story, there's a lot of talk. There's a lot of describing the future.
There's describing the future, and there's also there isn't much action in the thing at all. And by action, I don't mean like Arnold Schwarzenegger action, which we'll get into a little bit later on.
Well, rather than telling.
Yeah.
There's a lot of telling.
Right. There's a lot of talk.
But it's interesting telling. It's interesting dialogue, and in a short story, that's totally reasonable. You can tell your whole story in dialogue, and it works fine.
Right.
On the show, it would be a little bit weird if he said, "Yeah, I'm from the future, and we're at war with these other guys. They're bad. We're good. No big deal."
But the story as it plays out is much more 12 Angry Men than Terminator 2. You know.
Yes.
So that I thought was really cool, and I think it was a very simple anti-war tale. I think it was very effective. I think the descriptions of the future were really interesting. Like, it does seem kind of timeless, like the way that they were describing his clothes and everything like that. I'm like, wow, this is really really well done. And if someone were to tell me that it was written in 1957, I'd be like, really? Because I would have guessed like 1995. But
well, I mean, you just pushed the Terminator button.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that movie definitely was inspired by the idea of the future being a nebulous sort of intangible context.
Yeah.
But the present day is the present day. You can move beyond 1980, and everyone still knows that that happened.
Yeah.
It doesn't date it because that's when it occurred.
Yeah. So for the episode, like we were saying, a few things changed. For one thing, there was a second soldier, which kind of it gets stuck in the time field for a while and then pops up at the end. It's a little strange.
Well, you know how time travel works. Generally speaking, when somebody accidentally goes back in time, somebody else goes accidentally back in time with them, but shows up in the past a little bit later.
Right. But the
that's just how it works.
But the main story itself, the soldier, played by Michael Ansara, who played Kang on Star Trek.
Yeah.
He comes back in much the same manner. But once he gets here, the scientist guy basically decides to take him under his wing and try to find a way to get him to integrate into society. He takes him home to live with his family. He really works with him on his language skills and trying to communicate.
Which, and, by the way, would make a killer sitcom.
I kept on thinking the same thing. I'm like, this feels kind of sitcom-y. You know, there's like a whole thing with his son and how his son is picking up the slang from the future.
Yeah.
It's like the daughter, and the daughter is not taking any crap from him.
It's like Mr. Belvedere, if Mr. Belvedere had really severe PTSD from a war in the future.
It's like Small Wonder, but with a Klingon instead of a little girl.
It's like Alf, if Alf killed tons of people.
Yeah, you know, any of these things.
There are a lot of different TV show concepts. It's like Harry and the Hendersons, if it was exactly like that show was that no one remembers because it was that stupid.
But then, in the end, things go badly, and the other guy shows up, and some other stuff happens, and it's much more complicated. It's much more complicated narrative. Not to say that it's a complicated narrative, but it's a much more complicated narrative than the short story.
The short story is a very simple thing. It's like there's a guy from the future. Hey, let's not do that. Mm-hmm. The Outer Limits episode, it's a guy from the future. How are we going to deal with him? He's kind of crazy and he's dangerous. Oh, there's another guy from the future. Oh, that guy that we just made friends with totally killed that dude because he protected us because he was a person. Oh, or because he always did that and that was his programming.
Yeah.
It's kind of a tough call.
All right.
It would be really helpful if he wasn't dead. We could ask him.
So, I mean, what did you think about the episode? You said you liked it more than the short story?
No, I like the short story more, but I think that the many elements are handled better in the episode. I think that the dialogue between people makes a lot of the weird sort of decisions that are made make a lot more sense. The sort of the professor studying the guy from the future in the short story feels difficult to believe. I have a hard time buying into his character as a guy who's talking to a man from the future and is like, I should go on the road and tell people to not go to war because of this. That's a really strange leap.
Mm-hmm.
And when there is sort of a back and forth between various people, like the guy saying, I want to take this guy home and teach him to, you know, live with people, it makes a lot of sense in that context. Like, it makes more sense because of the political, essentially, the political dynamic at play. And that helped it, that helped the plausibility of the present day events for me.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely thought that the story was better than the episode. I mean, I guess the episode is okay, but it kind of really drags at the end. And the whole time I kept on thinking, like, when are we going to get to this cool, you know, thing at the end where they turn him into an instrument for peace? And it never really happens quite the way that it does in the book. And the episode seemed a lot cheesier. You know, like the description of his clothes in the story, like if like I kept on thinking, like, wow, you know, this sounds like basically the way that they costume superhero movies today. Like I could basically see them like sticking the Superman suit from Man of Steel on this dude and being like, boom, that's his clothing. And it's like, I can totally see that as an alien's clothing, and then as a future guy's clothing, and then, you know, you see the episode, and it's like Captain Proton, and it's like, wow, you know, are you guys taking this seriously or not?
Very appropriate reference.
Do you not understand what he's doing here? And where was Ellison to be like, dude, do you not understand that this guy looks ridiculous here?
I think that what happened was that they got to that page and they were like, he's a soldier from the future. What do people from the future look like? And they read the description and they're like, we can't just make that. We've got literally 5 days
sure
to shoot this whole
sure
thing.
Sure, but I mean, this really looks like they took something out of storage and they were like, future guy. Like, there was a box labeled future guy costume.
See, to me, it reads like the entire thing reads like they thought, soldier from the future. He's wearing body armor. Let's get some old-timey body armor, like a knight, and retrofit it with some shiny, glowy things.
And put a little... Did you see he had a little lightning bolt stitched on his sleeve?
Yeah.
Because that's futuristic.
They're indicating that he's a soldier, and they're creating a visual motif that says soldier in a way that we already understand. It's kind of weird. It's a strange choice, but I mean, the design aesthetics are constantly in flux.
I did like the portrayal of the future world. It was very similar to Terminator, which we'll get into in a second. But well, that for like the scale that they did there, and I was reading a little bit about it, how they shot it on something called like the Sunset Stage at Paramount, which was like 3 times the size of a normal stage, and it had a sky in the background, and I imagine it was, generally speaking, used for things like Gone with the Wind, you know? But yeah. Here they were like, let's turn it into a crazy future terrifying thing, and that set was really impressive. The effects there, I thought, for what they were going for were really effective, and I was really impressed by what they did with that little scene in the future.
Yeah.
But, once they got back to 1964 America, it's like, what are you guys doing? It really is sort of like Leave It to Beaver land. And it just seemed really clunky to me. I don't know. It did not work nearly as well as the short story.
Well, sure. There's a lot of stuff in the short story that is almost impossible to capture in live action. The descriptions of the future war are so intricate and poetic that I could easily see somebody reading it and just going like, that sounds cool. I have no idea what that would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, like when I first read it, like the first thing I thought was, I think that somebody read this and it seeped into their brain. And over the course of several years, they kept seeing it in their head, and eventually they were like, oh, I know how this would look. And then they put that into a movie called Terminator, because the future war looks exactly like it's described.
Well, we've been dancing around this long enough. Let's get into this. The Terminator. James Cameron, 1984, 20 years after this episode aired, 27 years after the short story had been written, this movie comes out.
Yeah.
Everyone is familiar with The Terminator. If you haven't seen The Terminator, turn this podcast off right now and go watch The Terminator and then come back. We'll wait for you.
I'm not going to wait.
Okay, fine. We won't wait for you. So if you watch The Terminator, depending on what copy you have, but on almost all copies which exist today, at the end of the movie, you will see a credit, which is very vague, which says, the producers wish to acknowledge the works of Harlan Ellison. Well, what it means is that basically Harlan Ellison, upon becoming aware of the plot of The Terminator, specifically the beginning of the movie,
mm-hmm.
felt that he was being ripped off and thought that, you know, he, whether, I guess, intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know, Soldier was a primary influence on that aspect of the film. And Harlan Ellison brought a lawsuit against James Cameron and the producers of the film.
Yeah.
Cameron denies that. You know, he acknowledges that Outer Limits was an influence and that, you know, it's quite possible that, you know, he took things from there subliminally or abstractly. But by no means was he trying to rip off Harlan Ellison with Soldier. Regardless of this, it would have been hard to prove. I think everyone is sort of in agreement that it would have been really hard to prove, but so as not to drag things out any further, a decision was made to settle out of court.
Yeah. It would be very difficult to argue that there was no influence.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems kind of fuzzy to argue that it was a very significant influence.
I mean, if you ask me, I think it's fairly clear that, yes, James Cameron had seen this episode of Outer Limits.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think anything beyond a passing influence or a half-remembered dream or thought or whatever is not there. You know, I don't think he was dissecting this and then, you know, sticking it in his movie.
Right. I think that it's part of the weird way that Harlan Ellison thinks. Harlan Ellison is very smart. And I think that I've heard Harlan Ellison say that everything is a rip off of something else. And he can actually cite to you all the places that things are being ripped off from. And he's probably got a point, because he can actually probably tell you every single influence for all of his works. And so it would be easy for him to see other people as ripping him off, because people aren't able to remember everything the way he is, because he's got a ridiculously powerful brain, and it works like a computer. It's intricate. It's meticulous.
Yeah, you know, even in Star Trek, Arena, you know, by Gene Kuhn, is credited as based on a story by someone else, and he wrote that as an original screenplay, and then someone in the production discovered this short story, which was very, very similar, and, you know, it was one which he had probably read and forgotten about, completely accidental. It is what it is. You know, this, I think, is even less that. Well, check out the episode, check out the movie, decide for yourself.
Yeah, read the short story. That's the one where the comparison becomes kind of difficult to hide.
Yeah. And as far as Star Trek people are concerned, we did mention Michael Ansara's in this. He plays the lead. He plays the soldier in the episode, and he, of course, played Kang, the Klingon, in Day of the Dove and Blood Oath and Flashback and Voyager. So he also was the voice of Mr. Freeze on Batman, the animated series. So that's cool.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. All right. Any final thoughts on Soldier?
There's a lot of things that I like about a lot of Harlan Ellison's work. I really like how cleverly he builds his stories in weird metaphorical ways, despite never straying too far away from plausibility, even though he gets into some really weird stuff. It's always sort of rooted in a kind of logic, which I think a lot of people don't really get. Even his really weird concepts like Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man, there's a sort of plausibility to them. And Soldier is not an exception. And I think that more than anything else, that hard SF with big picture stuff is the real inspiration that James Cameron got from him. Because Ellison was certainly one of the earliest guys to do that super, super well.
Yeah.
And that is basically James Cameron's whole thing.
Yeah. For me, I do like this short story and episode. I like the short story a lot more than the episode. I think the episode was trying to be too much of a TV show and didn't really take advantage of how simple the story was. But I can't say that it's bad. And it is interesting to look at it in terms of the Terminator comparison as well. All right. So, Max, Colin's show, Trek News and Views, it's ending.
It is indeed.
Episode 100. It's being released, I think, this week or last week. I can't keep track of these things, but we're both on it.
Yeah.
And you can take a listen to that over on Trek FM, as well as the other shows on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
TOS Remastered with Dave Rossi.
We took one day and we all went down in front of a green screen. I had a Captain Kirk shirt on. I don't remember where I got it from. Oh, yes, I do. My closet.
Earl Grey.
Ensign Row Commentary.
Here we have someone who is kind of bucking authority and is kind of trying to go against the grain, but she does it in a way that's shows that she has some sort of depth of character.
The Orb.
His Way Commentary.
I love that he says, what does fun have to do with Major Kira? And James Darren's like, What do you mean, what is fun? Come on.
Face palm.
Yeah, exactly.
The ready room.
The catwalk.
But this was a really, his trainer, Scott Rowe, was talking about in the interview I did with him back in the day, how this was a hard show because normally when they had Porthos, it was Scott and Porthos working. And maybe one other character or two other characters. And these, if you watch how Porthos was in this show, they kind of had him in the quarters with Scott. And I watched most of the show. I didn't see the last nth degree of it. But most of the time they would do stuff with him like peeking out of a bulkhead and all that.
To the journey!
USS Voyager.
If it was like really blooming with color, you're like, oh, they're going really fast or something's happening. Like you could,
yeah, excitement!
Like it was instantly, you instantly knew exactly what was going on.
And if Q Jr. is on board, it becomes a disco.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Harlan Ellison.
Harlan Ellison is a crazy person because only a crazy person could come up with such an amazing name for a sci-fi drug. Come on, that's so much better than bath salts. Why don't we call them the Jewels of Sound?
Warp 5.
Trip Tucker.
You know, they're not really career Starfleet people, even though Trip has had a career in Starfleet. He's an engineer, you know, and that's what he does and that's what he loves. And so all this other stuff's really new to him.
Literary Treks.
The Best of Klingons.
We haven't talked about yet, Chris, but there is one Klingon in here that is not like the other.
That's right. One of these Klingons is not like the other. One of these Klingons doesn't belong.
One of these Klingons is a friend of the Federation.
One of these Klingons and Bryce will get along.
Wow, this show has gone off the rails.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and get in on the daily Trek Talk. We have new shows for you every day, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can stream and download files from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. So if you haven't read Harlan Ellison's Soldier, which we both highly recommend.
Yes, you should do that.
Or, even better, you could have someone read it to you.
No, you can't.
Yes, you can.
Stop lying.
No, I'm not lying. It's the future. Ridiculous. It's the future, and the future is Audible.com, who sponsors Commentary Trek Stars. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for, like Soldier. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics, like Soldier, to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic books you've yet to read, like Soldier, or the latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank you and Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek FM. So as always, you can find us on Trek FM, or you can find our other show, Commentary Track Stars Off Topic, on CommentaryTrackStars.com, which we do with our friend Brandon, who is actually sitting in the room creepily watching us as we do this now.
Like the smoking man in many episodes of The X-Files.
Yep. You can also find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars or email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. And we will be back next week with Tisto to talk about Harlan Ellison's other episode of The Outer Limits, Demon with a Glass Hand.